Coming up on Weekend America.
Bill used to fly over the Soviet Union, unsure if it was a test run or the end of the world.
We never actually knew whether it was for real or not. But if it were the real thing, of course, we would have nothing to come back to.
Catching up with Cold War veterans. I'm John Moe. Speaking of fear, the 2008 economy.
The optimists have been wrong, and the pessimists have been right. But there becomes a turning point where the gurus of darkness turn out to be wrong because they keep singing the same song.
Could it be that what goes down may come up? And as college students take a break from classes, some struggle to break with addiction.
There was someone who could get me the drugs I wanted, and that person lived in Minneapolis, so going to Augsburg was the logical next step for my addiction.
Trying to get sober and stay sober in a party atmosphere. Weekend America, after the news.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
From American Public Media, it's Weekend America. I'm John Moe in St. Paul. It's our final show of 2008. We're looking back from an economic perspective. We're looking back with our eyes somewhat averted, maybe holding a hand up. It's like Medusa. You can't look directly into the eyes of the economy or you'll be turned to stone. This hour, we'll talk about that economy and try to figure out why things got so horrible so quickly and then got even more horrible more quickly. Also, is there hope for 2009? Yes, some, kinda. Stay tuned. How did the economy affect you this year?
I've lost about 50% of my 401k.
Now places aren't hiring as much, and it's difficult to make some money sometimes.
No, the economy hasn't really affected me this year. I think sort of working for the government.
I am a realtor, so as you can imagine, the market is really slow, but I do expect that the market will start to come back after the new administration comes into office, and as we go into the spring market, I expect that, you know, things will get better again.
Leave it to people selling real estate to cheer you up. Those voices came from Lincoln, Nebraska, St. Louis, and Washington, D.C. This weekend marks the 17th anniversary of the collapse of the Soviet Union, and with that milestone, the end of the Cold War. For many Americans who were on the front lines of that standoff, this weekend will be observed as if it were a holiday, talking about people who flew the Berlin airlift or played cat-and-mouse games with Soviet subs, like something out of a Tom Clancy novel, except real. Independent producer Eric Malinsky says these retired servicemen are now facing a new battle.
Bill Robinson was part of an elite crew, people who had their finger on the button. He flew a B-52 bomber in 1968, circling the Arctic for 24 hours at a time. If given the order, he would have nuked Moscow.
We had one purpose and only one purpose, and that was to put our bombs on the target regardless of battle damage, regardless of anything other than complete destruction of the airplane. So we all knew that we were basically flying a suicide mission.
Well, officially they were called Chrome Dome missions. Bill worked for the Strategic Air Command, or SAC. They were tested constantly, rehearsing World War III over and over again.
Every time we had a practice alert, we never actually knew whether it was for real or not. But if it were the real thing, of course, we would have nothing to come back to. In the back of our minds and my mind, I knew that my family would probably be vaporized.
Bill and his crewmates were on the front lines of the Cold War. But when the Soviet Union fell, there were no victory parades, no medal ceremonies. Gorbachev was barely clinging to power. And the first President Bush was worried that if it looked like America was gloating, there might be a backlash in the Soviet Union. Now, Bill Robinson understands that, but he still felt unappreciated.
It would be nice to have somebody say thank you. You know, it would have been nice to have somebody say, well, as my old ops officer said, it was a real bucket of snot, but thanks.
Bill is part of a growing movement of retired servicemen who are supporting the American Cold War Veterans Association. The organization is lobbying Congress to create a Cold War Service Medal. They have the support of 7 senators, but the Pentagon is against it. Here's the problem. The Department of Defense does not consider the Cold War a real war. And they're worried that if they give medals to people who didn't serve in combat, they'll water down the whole meaning of the word veteran.
I'm Scott Lecuyer.
Scott Lecuyer believes that he was in a real war,
and, alert
and the contribution of his crewmates needs to be recognized.
Minuteman missile silos.
Sometimes I wonder if President Reagan was still around and conscious of this, would he have recognized us? And I've spoken to Ronald Reagan, actually, on a Christmas day when I was out in a missile site once. He called us and said, Merry Christmas.
Scott spent 4 years as a chief mechanic at a nuclear missile silo. The job was grueling. The missiles were constantly malfunctioning, but the base had to be fully operational in case the Soviets took a first strike. The crew was tested every day, not knowing if it was the real thing. One of Scott's roommates couldn't handle the stress. He was kicked out.
I can't tell you how much that guy did for the mission. He couldn't do the job, but he propped us up so much so he might as well have been the truck that drove us there. And when they kicked him out, it was unbelievable to all of us because, you know, he was like our parent. We didn't realize he couldn't go home because of the family issues, and he hung himself in our room. I have a flag that's on my mantle right now that was flying over the squadron at the time, and I keep it in a box in his memory.
Those memories weigh heavily on Scott. He had trouble adjusting to the outside world, and he describes his experience as being like underground solitary confinement. Scott was eventually diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder. He showed up at a local VA hospital, and that's when he discovered he wasn't technically a veteran because he didn't serve during an official period of war like Vietnam.
I was locked out from being a new applicant because of my service dates weren't during a war period. And I went crazy, and that's when I really got involved.
Scott now recruits members for the American Cold War Veterans Association. He's hoping to change the system, which he thinks is unfair.
Everybody's made hay on the Cold War, from authors to politicians to the media. Everybody for 50 years has made their careers on the Cold War. And it was us that carried out that mission. And the fact that we're forgotten is unbelievable.
Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton have pledged their support, but getting money's going to be tough. A new generation of soldiers is coming home with pressing concerns. The Cold War veterans might have to hunker down for a long fight. The payoff may be years down the road. But they're used to that. In New York City, I'm Eric Molinsky for Weekend America.
This year was all about the R word when it comes to the economy, talking about recession. It's a concept. It was something that was in the air all year long. We talked about how we might be in it or we might soon be in it. And then it turned out we had been in it the entire year. We'd been in a recession. And before this year, how often did you think about words like bailout? In 2008, names like Lehman Brothers and Bear Stearns and Merrill Lynch, they moved off the business pages and onto the front pages. Next stop, those businesses are going to be in the history books. This year, the economy dominated our minds. Chris Farrell, American Public Media's chief economic correspondent, is here to sift through the economic news of 2008. He and I have offices just a few doors down from each other, but we, until this all really got out of control, we didn't have a lot of interaction with each other. But over the past few months, all these crises seem to spring up over the weekends. Well, Chris, welcome back.
Hello.
How did things snowball and get so crazy so quickly over the course of this fall heading into winter?
The moment is the failure of Lehman Brothers.
September.
So now remember that in March, we had engineered the rescue and essentially the failure of Bear Stearns,
yes.
Legendary investment bank. So that disappeared.
And it was a storm cloud.
But then we knew Lehman Brothers was in trouble. And the attitude was, the sense was, and I shared this, everybody knows Lehman's in trouble. So we can't have the government bailing out everybody. We can't have this. This
right.
is just not the American way.
That's not the way capitalism works.
No. Lehman failed, And what it turned out is, oh my God, that was the reaction in the global capital markets. And the next thing that you know, the global capital markets have seized up. And that's when we start talking about the greatest financial crisis since the Great Depression.
Is that approach to thinking about it by holding it up next to the Great Depression making the problem worse or changing the problem in some way?
You know, part of me says you're absolutely right. And there's this very bizarre aspect, I don't even follow it, that we're refighting the New Deal. Was the New Deal good? Was the New Deal bad? But I think what does come out of the lesson of the 1930s and what is having an impact today, and is it actually affecting you and me, is that we've taken two lessons. One is, on the fiscal side, borrow. You don't worry about the budget deficit. You just don't worry about it. And on the monetary side, you do whatever you got to do to keep the system operating. So my sense is that's where the optimism should come from, that on the fiscal and monetary side of the equation, whether it's the U.S. government, we go to Europe, we go to China, everybody's operating under the same playbook. Let's not allow this recession to become a Great Depression. So what we really need to have is corporations, CEOs to say, hey, you know what? It's going to be better tomorrow. It's going to be better. So I'm going to start investing. I'm not going to invest in a plant, but I'm just going to start buying some high-tech equipment. I'm going to invest to grow. And if business starts to invest to grow and then they start hiring people and then we're starting to make more wages and we'll spend a little bit.
Isn't that just as speculative as the trust in credit that got us into this mess in the first place?
Well, the whole system works on trust and the whole system works on optimism. Joseph Schumpeter, everyone loves Joseph Schumpeter because of his expression, creative destruction. He was the economist that came up with that phrase. And anyway, he had this really profound statement. He said, you know, when times are dark, wisdom is saying things are going to get worse because there's a part of us that believes that. Part of us says, that's a really convincing case.
Because things have been getting worse up to this point.
Things have been getting worse up to this point, and you're absolutely right. The optimists have been wrong, and the pessimists have been right. Mm. But there becomes a turning point where the gurus of darkness turn out to be wrong because they keep singing the same song, and the gurus of the sun also rises, you know, turn out to be right. Trader Joe's came out of the 73-74 recession. Business Week, the first issue, was published in September 1929. How's that for timing? In the end, the optimism does reemerge. There are new opportunities that are there. What the government is trying to do right now is get enough money and support into the system so that, or to give basically a realistic basis for the optimism.
American Public Media senior economist and my good friend, Chris Farrell. Thanks, Chris.
Thanks a lot.
Weekend America is brought to you in part by Target, giving 5% of its income to the community since 1946. That now adds up to over $3 million every week.
We will make complete and total sense of the election of Barack Obama, the economy, and the war all in less than 10 minutes. 2008, good news, bad news, no news, next on Weekend America. We'll be right back. From American Public Media, it's Weekend America. I'm John Moe, and this year might have been confusing to you. You might have had a hard time making sense of the grand scope, the huge sweep of history that we all undertook together. But you've come to the right radio show. We're going to sort everything out that happened over the course of the year, or at least some of the big stories that happened over the course of the year, into handy categories of good news, bad news, or no news. Here to join us is our esteemed panel, author John Ridley. Hello, John.
Hey, John. How are you?
Good, thanks. Yale literature professor Amy Hungerford. Hello, Amy.
Hi, John.
And associate editor of The Atlantic, Rehan Salam. Hello, Rehan.
Hi, John.
This year, and I'm not sure a lot of people know about this, but Democratic Illinois Senator Barack Obama was elected president. He defeated Republican Arizona Senator John McCain, and earlier in the year, in a protracted battle that took 13 years, he defeated Hillary Clinton. Was the course of this election and its outcome good news, bad news, or no news?
The fact that this election, from the beginning, did not look like any other presidential election and did not end like any other presidential election, and probably is the obelisk that will mark the end of all previous forms of presidential election, I think is a really, really good thing.
I think this was great news for various reasons. This was like its own massive stimulus program. So much money got spent on these campaigns in a down year financially. All the money that got spent on making commercials and printing stuff up and robocalls even, you know, that stimulated the economy. Not a bad thing.
And also Obama baby teas.
Right.
That was our number one export this year.
After Sarah Palin went off the campaign trail, retail sales plummeted.
Yeah, it's true.
So,
true.
You know, Neiman Marcus couldn't ship anymore. What happened? What? We were doing so well.
The younger guy won, and there's a lot of talk of Republicans going into retrenchment, of having their Dr. Phil moment, of having their years in the desert. Was this a healthy, good news kind of purging of the old, in with the new, Rehan takes over the party kind of scenario for you then?
That would be a dark day for America and the world, I think. I think we're going to see things get worse rather than better in the short and medium term. I think that, you know, you have a party that doesn't look like the rest of the country anymore. The problem is, you know, is this going to be a 30-year thing? Do we need really deep rethinking? Or is this a kind of tactical thing where, you know, we could come roaring back and there doesn't have to be that same deep rethink? I'm in the deep rethink camp, and I think that this, you know, will help that process along. Maybe, but I think that there might have to be another couple of defeats before it really sinks in.
And by the way, I think you have to segregate the Republicans and the neoconservatives. I don't think there's anything wrong with being Republican. I voted Republican, but it was the neoconservative movement that really, I think, destroyed the Republican Party and their push away of people who are different. You know, the idea you're supposed to vote your aspirations, but ultimately, particularly in the 11th hour, people realized that the aspirational movement doesn't really work. You know, it's still the little guy in the middle class guy who gets hammered.
Next topic. This year, the economy, well, you pick the verb, collapsed, ran into trouble, cratered, melted into a puddle, experienced a fit of pique. Was the lousy economy good news, bad news, or no news?
There's obviously a lot of bad news. We were very close, and still are close, to just being absolutely bypassed by China, India, and Russia. And this global implosion has really slowed down these economies. Now, there's obviously some human pain in those countries as well, and I'm not happy about that. But I do think that America has the ability to restart and reset more quickly. And there is an opportunity for us to retake some of these manufacturing jobs, some of these domestic jobs, find new domestic jobs before these countries are able to reboot.
I'm with John. I think that there's an enormous opportunity for ingenuity here. And the short-term pain feels like the end of the world until you have your next idea about how to make your life work.
One thing I want to throw out there briefly is just, you know, if there is a real long-term economic downturn, won't there be a baby bust? It's just interesting to think. I mean, you know, there was the Depression generation that ended up being the greatest generation. And, you know, what's going to happen to these kids?
I have young kids, and I can't even find factory jobs for them. right now. They're not hiring at the shoe factory. Last topic. Most recaps of the year's events are dominated by the election of Barack Obama or financial calamity. But all the while, there have been a couple of wars going on in Iraq and Afghanistan. There's been talk of withdrawing troops from Iraq. There's been a surge of troops into Iraq, the success of which became an issue in the campaign for a while. What kind of news have the wars been this year?
Well, it's really hard to put it in one category. I guess I'm going to say qualified good news in Iraq. It seems like from the reports, the casualties are down and there are fewer violent attacks, although there are still way too many. Afghanistan, whole different story. That's been getting worse and worse. The election of Barack Obama should help in that respect because he's much more focused on Afghanistan than Bush was.
For the most part, Iraq is no news, which is actually bad news. I think that the line that was pushed, and to a degree I do accept it, that the surge worked. It certainly was instrumental in reducing violence, but and the fact that this was not an issue during the campaign, not as much of an issue. You know, this war in Iraq is a continuing issue, and we need to deal with it, and we're not talking about it, and our leaders haven't been talking about it in the way that I think we need to.
Those wars have been the big issue for me for a really long time, and I think that, you know, the good news taking the sweep of the year is this idea that, you know, Democrats are going to want to set the war in Afghanistan right. They're going to feel ownership of it. And I think that's valuable because the real tragedy of these wars is that they were partisan wars. They were wars that were fought by, you know, kind of one half of the country in a way because, you know, the Bush White House didn't make any effort to make the case. You know, it was our way or the highway. It was this very kind of aggressive way of selling the strategy. But, you know, I think that you saw a lot of very good things happen in Iraq. And Afghanistan really is a really tense, fraught situation, a lot of bad news there potentially. At the same time, you know, Afghanistan is a society that I think, you know, where we can make a difference. But I also worry about what Republicans are going to do. Let's say Obama says, we're going all in. We're going to try to fix Afghanistan. So are we going to see Republicans suddenly turn isolationist right when it's a Democratic president who's on the line? That really, really worries me.
John?
Well, first, I don't think that's neoconservative.
Oh, I totally am.
No, but that's good, reasonable. That's like neoconservative. That's good thought. I like you more now. I'd vote for you.
And on that day, John Ridley became a neoconservative.
I never really listened to him before. They make sense. I just, you know, it sounded bad. It was like Latinish. I always was afraid of Latin.
Well, it's been a rough year. It's been a puzzling year. It's been a big year, but fortunately, now it all makes sense. Thank you, panel.
Thanks, John.
Thanks, John.
Thank you. Happy New Year.
John Ridley is an author and the founding editor of ThatMinorityThing.com. Amy Hungerford professes literature at Yale University. Rehan Salam is associate editor of The Atlantic and co-author of Grand New Party, How Republicans Can Win the Working Class and Save the American Dream.
Weekend America, supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. This program is made possible by grants from CPB, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from public radio stations including WBUR Boston, WCPN Cleveland, and KPCC Los Angeles.
College is a great place to learn and make friends. Pretty popular place to get drunk or high, too. But if you want to get sober, well, that's a challenge. Ahead on Weekend America. We'll be right back. From American Public Media, it's Weekend America. I'm John Moe, and it is time once again to listen to your weekend soundtrack, the song that moves you through Saturday and Sunday, maybe a little bit of Friday night too. Our latest comes from Charles Womack in Tucson, Arizona. His weekend soundtrack is 12 Diablos by Wii. What makes this your weekend soundtrack?
Well, it was playing when I got out for my first mountain bike ride after a long absence from mountain bike riding.
Why the absence?
I had a stroke due to a neck injury in late December of 2007, and I was not allowed to ride mountain bikes until I was through with Coumadin therapy. And I had been at work on Friday, and the song came up on my iTunes. Ended up riding on Saturday for the first time, and it made an even bigger impression upon me.
How long did it take from the time you had the stroke to the time you were back on your bike?
It was about 6 months, roughly, and it took me about a month to getting around to feeling like mountain bike ready, so it was about 7 months.
Did you feel the absence?
Yeah, I missed the trails a lot. I missed mountain biking a lot. The walking through the desert is always great, and I've done it for many years, but it's much different when you're going on a mountain bike and up and down the hills, and you get the gravity, and you claw your way up the other side of the hill, and you have to watch out for these big rocks, and there's all these different things to do at once. So mountain biking is a completely different world from hiking.
How well does this song match the terrain that you go biking on?
Well, it really does. This song, with its punchy bass noise and this wavering melodic background and the impossibly fast drum beat, matches the terrain really well, because you have to hammer the pedals, you're going up and down these hills, and you pull a few G's when you get down to the bottom. You really feel it. And it reminded me a lot of that punchy bass sound you hear in this genre of music.
How is your recovery going, Charles?
Well, they say I'm headed for a complete recovery. I saw the neurologist on Friday. His name is Dr. Cool, and he really is cool.
Wait, are you sure this is a real doctor?
Oh, yeah, he's as real as can be. He's the head of neurology at the University of Arizona. He's a good doctor. If you have a problem that's real scary like this, he's the kind of guy you want on your side.
You want Dr. Cool.
Yeah, and he said I'm doing great, and my creative side is strong. The old mountain biking magic is definitely coming back. I really felt that this weekend. I mean, this thing was scary when it happened. The entire left side of my body didn't work.
So what have you learned from this?
I learned that I really love mountain biking. I really love music, and I really love being alive.
That was Charles Womack of Tucson, Arizona. The song, which is hard to sing along to, but enjoyable nonetheless, is 12 Diablos by Wii. You can learn more about it and listen to some of our other weekend soundtracks. It's all at our website, weekendamerica.org. We'll be right back.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
From American Public Media, it's Weekend America. I'm John Moe. For some Americans, making holidays merry involves drinking beverages that make them feel more merry. But for people in recovery, the holidays are a very difficult time. Time to test their hard-earned sobriety in many cases. We're going now to Augsburg College in Minneapolis, which has one of the country's few on-campus drug and alcohol recovery programs. It's called Step Up, and the students don't just stay away from drugs. They have to make grades, they have to go to 12-step meetings, they have to keep their residence hall clean. The idea is that if recovering students can operate as a community, relapse will become less tempting. A few months ago, Weekend America's Hillary Frank brought us the story of one of Step Up's students. He asked us to use only his first name, Sam.
Sam fell into addiction the same way they warned you about in junior high. At 11, he and his friends were sneaking beers from their parents' fridges. At 13, he started smoking marijuana with the older kids next door, then by himself before school. And at 17, that's when things really escalated. Sam was at his friend's house playing video games.
Like, that was all we wanted to do, you know, playing Halo until our thumbs were sore. So one day my friend had some, you know, powder cocaine, and, you know, I was kind of looking at it like, I know it's bad, but when I see it right there, you know, it looks pretty harmless to me. And we'd all decided, you know, let's all take our first bump. And I remember it's like as soon as that powder went up my nose, it was just like, you know, this is what God wanted for me.
With drugs, Sam could be dark. He was the sullen guy carving the 9-inch nails insignia into his desk. He was the guy who wrote deep, messed up poetry. But he pretty much kept that side of himself secret. On face value, Sam was a jock. A football player, the captain of the basketball team. It was thrilling to think he had everyone fooled. Well, everyone except his mom. By the time he was in college nearby, she knew something was terribly wrong. One day, after a football game, she asked him to stop lying.
I made my mother cry right there. And it was just like, whatever, I'll just blow you off right now. I don't want to speak to you. I have a party to go to, you know, I'm a big deal. You know, that's like really what I thought, you know. It's like going out with the other jocks and we're going to grunt and do keg stands.
I wanted to see what Sam's old jock parties were like. So on a Friday night, I headed to a house off campus where I was told some Augsburg football players lived. The scene was pretty much what I remember of frat parties back when I was in college. Some girls in the living room were dancing and eventually falling over. Around them were some guys on couches, totally zoning out. A scrawny guy came up to me with an absolute citron bottle and offered me a pull.
A pull? A pull.
She doesn't want to shing out.
Another kid put his arm around me and the football dudes pried him off.
Be careful, man.
Then tried to boot him out. The next day, I met up with Sam again. Where would you have fallen into that mix if you were at that party?
I mean, you know, you talked about the people falling over on the dance floor, the people sitting on the couch, the people throwing their arm around you, and you're like, that could have very well been me in all those situations.
At first glance, Sam back in his drinking days might look exactly like your average college binge drinker. But there's a big difference between an addict and a non-addict, or normie, as the addiction community calls them. A normie can walk away from a substance at any time with no symptoms of withdrawal, but an addict keeps needing more. By sophomore year, Sam was into prescription drugs like Vicodin and Adderall. He was doing poorly in school. But he perked up in his psychology class when his teacher brought up a certain concept.
The concept of state-dependent learning.
Basically, that means if you learn something when you're intoxicated, you'll remember it better when you're intoxicated. So Sam raised his hand and asked,
wait, so does that mean if I study when I'm drunk, you know, I should take the test drunk?
Sam did a little research and decided, yes, that's exactly what it means.
And then I went nuts with Adderall. Like, it's like, oh, I don't need to sleep anymore. Oh, I can type 10-page papers the night before. And it also enabled me to smoke copious amounts of marijuana, which I couldn't do normally because I would have just fallen asleep.
And then something happened that turned Sam's life around.
PlayStation 3 came out.
That's right, PlayStation 3. there were some students at Augsburg offering people $250 to camp out at Best Buy and wait for the systems to arrive for 3 days.
It was in November. It was just freezing cold.
The thing Sam hadn't counted on was the first 20 people in line being in Step Up, Augsburg's addiction recovery program. He was afraid they'd try and brainwash him.
I'd go on little walks by myself and come back just red-eyed. Or I would down a bottle, like, out of, like, a Pepsi bottle. And one of them did just, like, nonchalantly tell me, just like, you know, everyone here knows you're high. I'm like, what are you talking about? Like, I'm not. It's like, dude, don't worry about it. Like, no one cares. And for me to be just completely miserable and to see all these people, like, they had barbecues. And, I mean, it was basically like a vacation from school. And I realized that, you know, these people are just like me. They're addicts and they're sober and they're loving life.
A couple months later, Sam went to the Step Up office. The director told him he'd need 6 months of sobriety before he could join the program. That meant another semester of living with his jock friends.
I'd wake up and I'd smell pot, beer cans everywhere. You know, obviously someone puked in my sink. People just lying like half naked on the floor.
Sam was appalled. But if this wasn't how he was going to spend his free time, what would he do instead? His new buddies in Step Up gave him some advice. For starters, they said, don't hang out in your room.
It's like, well, where else would I be? It's like, oh yeah, the college has a library. You know, I've never been there before.
Sam spent a lot of time in the library and getting tutored by teachers. Remember state-dependent learning? Sam had been intoxicated when he'd learned how to be a college student, even a high school student. Reading, writing, studying. He had to relearn all of it, sober. He says his proofreading skills still aren't where they used to be when he was high.
Have your musical tastes changed?
Oh, yes. I mean, it's kind of nerdy, but I'm very much into classical music.
When Sam got sober, he got a job stacking dishes in the school cafeteria. After work, he'd go over to the out-of-tune Baby Grand in the dining hall. That's actually him playing Moonlight Sonata. The way he taught himself to play it is pretty remarkable. He'd put one ear on top of the piano, have an earphone from his iPod in the other. This sort of thing would have completely embarrassed the old Sam. But that's true of pretty much everything the new Sam does for fun. His biggest love these days? Theater.
It's just like I can't get enough of it.
He especially likes tragedies, like Chekhov's The Seagull.
I was depressed into my toes in that show, and it's just like there's this powerful, powerful feeling that overcomes me, that brings me right back to the most wretched times of my life.
Sam knows it sounds strange to say that he loves tragedies because they make him feel so horrible.
But at the same time, you know, to see the curtain fall, the lights to black out, it's just an instant sense of relief. You know, it's a beautiful reminder that that isn't my life anymore.
In Minneapolis, I'm Hillary Frank for Weekend America.
Sam is still in the Step Up Recovery Program at Augsburg College in Minneapolis. We first aired that story in March of this year, and since then, Sam has become a senior at Augsburg. Hillary Frank checked in with him to see how things are going.
I understand that you're an RA now in the sober dorm at Augsburg.
Yes.
Since you're living on the recovery floor, you're probably not dealing with, like, raging parties. But I know that you used to be the source of those raging parties in other dorms, and RAs, I think, used to be your nemesis. And so what's it like to be in the shoes of your former nemesis?
It's taught me a lot of humility, and I just try and be the leader I wanted to see. You know, if I was in their position, how would I ask the RA to deal with me? You know, it's something I'm working on, because you give an alcoholic a little bit of power, they'll take it a long way. As much as I used to hate the man, I'm kind of becoming one.
And what about,
Are you still really into tragedies?
I'm writing a tragedy, so yes. But I've also learned that as I've matured, I don't need as much tragedy on stage or in my life, because I would watch a tragedy 10 times at the Guthrie, and lately I found 2 will suffice. I don't need to feel heartbroken like that too many times.
When is your 2-year anniversary of sobriety?
God willing, I'll have 2 years of continuous sobriety January 7th, and I'll be in New York City for that time.
Mm, so it's really soon.
Yeah.
Do you plan on celebrating in any particular way?
One thing I'd like to celebrate is, you know, for myself, is to reflect. I'm a daily journal writer, so I like to turn the pages back in my journal. And it's just this very humbling experience to be like, this is where you were at 12 months ago. This is where you were at 18 months ago.
So we're coming up on New Year's Eve, the drinkiest day of the year.
I imagine.
And it's just a week before your 2-year anniversary of sobriety. How do you feel about New Year's Eve?
Well, it's no coincidence that my sober anniversary is a week after New Year's, because that was the resolution, and it took me a week to start it in 2007. So, mm-hmm. I mean, I don't want to put it New Year's Eve on too much of a pedestal, but you know, it's something to take into account. It's just like, you know, what is my motivation putting myself in Times Square on New Year's Eve?
That's where you're going to be.
That's where I'm going to be.
Really? You know, here.
Practice what I preach, right? But, yeah, you know, there's drinking every night of the year, especially on New Year's, I agree. But if I'm in the right headspace and with the support of other recovering alcoholics, I think I'll be all right.
Hillary Frank talking to Sam. You can learn more about the Augsburg College Step Up program at weekendamerica.org. When you look back on the events of the year, you should have seen them coming a mile away. Even the surprises. Especially the surprises. The omens you may have missed, next on Weekend America.
Weekend America, supported by Gather.com. If it's happening in the world, it's being discussed on Gather. People are talking about their weekends at Gather.com. And by Clarkson Potter, publishers of The Splendid Tables, How to Eat Supper, a holiday gift idea for people who love to eat. Now available at SplendidTable.org.
From American Public Media, it's Weekend America. I'm John Moe. I'm going to remember a lot of things about 2008. And I'll especially remember that this is the year I turned 40. It was shocking. It makes absolutely no sense to be surprised by your own birthday, but somehow I was, flabbergasted, wonderstruck. I swear I was just 24 the other day, and now, whammo, this? Wah? I wasn't depressed, mind you. I'm grateful for the life that I have. I wasn't elated either. You'll never catch me saying that 40 is the new 30. To me, 40 isn't the new 30. It's the new, oh my God, I'm going to die soon. Mostly, I was just stunned, which makes me sound like a real idiot. How could such a huge thing sneak up on a person? I can count. I knew it was coming. Here's the thing, though. If I'm stupid to not see the obvious thing about to happen, then we're all stupid. All of America. Because the big events of 2008 were completely predictable, and yet they blew our minds anyway. Look at housing. For years, Americans believed housing prices would always rise, that your house would be worth more next year than it was this year. Heck, it would be worth more on Thursday than it was on Wednesday. Now, why did we believe something like that? Because it was true. At least for a while, home values climbed and climbed. If you didn't feel like cashing in by selling, you could cash in on the equity your home had accumulated, meaning you could collect cash based on what you thought something would be worth later were you to sell it, but you didn't sell it, but you got the money anyway. To get even more cash on hand, you could finance your house with a subprime loan, with the faith that the markets would stay strong and everything would be okay. But didn't it seem wrong? Didn't it seem fishy even then, even in the boom times? Didn't it all seem too easy that your house would produce a crop of cash while you did nothing? Well, those instincts were right. It fell apart. We saw it coming a mile away, and yet we were stunned. And didn't the entire financial industry seem kind of insanely speculative and inherently imprudent and pretty much bananas? Well, come to think of it, yes, it did. And now we're in deep. Predictable? Yes. Shocking? Also, yes. It would have been hard to predict the multiple bank collapses, the enormous Ponzi scheme being run by a Wall Street deity, the wave of foreclosure home tours in cities all over the nation, or 26-year highs in unemployment. The scope of it all was shocking. The causes should not have been. Okay, let's move on to politics. Now, here's where you might think my whole 2008 was predictable concept would fall apart. You could argue that there was nothing predictable about the outcome of the presidential election or the success of Barack Obama. America elected a black president, the guy with Hussein in his name. He beat John McCain. He beat Hillary Clinton. Well, yeah, shocking, but not inevitable. The outgoing president was a Republican who governed without deliberation. He took pride in appearing to be a man of the people, even though he came from a dynastic family. He's not very good at delivering a speech, and importantly, he had among the lowest approval numbers in the history of the presidency. When Barack Obama declared his candidacy in February of 2007, I looked at him and I remember thinking, of course he's going to win. He'll win. And I say this now not to boast about my great political acumen or psychic abilities. I have none. But at the time, it just seemed obvious. Obama was the opposite of everything George W. Bush was. Conciliatory instead of divisive. He was articulate. He was deliberative. A Democrat. A member of a minority group. And he was talking about change in a time when an overwhelming number of Americans believed the country was pretty seriously on the wrong track. Of course he would win. Over the course of the rest of the campaign, there were so many other little storylines to follow that I ended up losing my belief in Obama's guaranteed victory, and I thought, hey, it's anyone's game. But I wonder now why I ever thought that the election was in doubt. I wonder why I was stunned about the predictable. One of the things historians will point to with Obama is branding. The O symbol was everywhere in the campaign. You couldn't get away from it. But let's talk for a minute about the font that they used. It's a font called Gotham. It's relatively new. It's highly geometrical. You saw it on all the signage the campaign used. From the website to the signs at the rallies to the Obama onesies for babies, same font every time. And it's just a font, sure, but don't underestimate it. A political campaign needs to adjust to events on the fly, but when everything you see from that campaign looks the same, it creates a feeling of consistency. And in 2008, consistency was very appealing. You always knew what the brand of Barack Obama was. It's stunning that Obama won, yes, perhaps, but when you look at the branding, it's predictable. Of course, it's one thing to pull off that level of branding when you're Nike or Walmart. It's something else entirely when you're a presidential campaign. Unless you figured out how to use the internet to organize resources and dollars better than any campaign ever has, of course. Whoever has the most consistent brand and is the best organized and raises the most money and uses technology best will win the election. So really, the major events of 2008 were big, but were they really news? Looking back on it now, they were as foreseeable as me turning 40. Could have circled them on the calendar. Of course, I couldn't have really predicted all these things in January. That's the trick. The news is only stunning because it takes a while to realize how predictable it actually was. So whatever happens next year already makes perfect sense. We will have seen it coming a mile away. We just don't know what we're seeing yet. And that's it for another hour of American Public Media's Weekend America. I talked to our staff about what their most memorable moment of 2008 was. Ben Adair became a father. Julia Barton became a mother again. Sasha Aslanian produces the program as well. So does Larissa Anderson, Rob Byers, Desiree Cooper, who enjoyed voting as a family in 08. Brendan Noonan's favorite part of 08 was hearing the voice of his father, brimming with joy when the Phillies won the World Series. We're also produced by Sam Keenan, Michael May, Michael Rayfield, whose year was highlighted by recording Waterfowl and Tanks, Ocean Kalen, whose numerous 2008 highlights would take all day and be dramatic, but he's doing well. Ariel Kitch, Angela Kim, Mark Sanchez, who enjoyed learning to surf in 2008. He wasn't in Minnesota when he learned to surf. Also Chris Wieg. Our theme music was created by Galactic. Our executive producer is Peter Clowney. Jim Russell created the show. You can get a free podcast of today's program from our website, weekendamerica.org. I'm John Moe. I enjoyed seeing my baby daughter born this year and moving to St. Paul and hosting this radio program for you. Bye now.
This program is made possible with support from AIR, the Association of Independents in Radio, and public radio stations including WMFE Orlando, KUOW Seattle, and KNOW St. Paul, and made possible by grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Weekend America is produced and distributed by
American Public Media.
I'm John Moe, host of Weekend America. Sometimes you just need to get away from the stress of the week. We'll take you somewhere new through stories and music.
The music is nothing but this distant, surreal sound, and it's like I'm being transported into this different world. It has something to do with my job or the week that was or civilization as I know it or anything.
All you have to do is sit and listen. We'll do the driving.